What you are about to hear is the story of a connection that was made between a television series and a viewer's life. Our television set sits in the corner of our living room, befriending us, educating us, inspiring us, making us laugh or cry or tear our hair out in frustration. It is a far more constant companion than most of the friends we will ever make, or even our family. The You and Who books are the story of that companionship, that connection, as told by the people who watch the programmes that make us come alive, chiefly, of course, Doctor Who. This podcast will relate some of those stories. You're listening to You and Who Talking, and I'm J.R. Southall, the creator and chief editor of the series. Making Television in Your Head, Survivors by J.R. Southall, 47, Exeter, UK. Favourite TV programme, Doctor Who. Like many people who write about television, think about television, or even just watch television, I've often dreamed about making television. And because I've dreamed about it often enough, I've ended up making television in my head. It's just a shame that reality has a habit of letting me down. My earliest firm television memory is of the black and gold Dalek Supreme chasing Doctor Who and Sarah Jane down the ramp and into the jungles of Spiridon in part 6 of Planet of the Daleks in May 1973. Hey, nobody tells you your memories aren't always going to be accurate. And thereafter, most of my other early cathode recollections are of the same series, mostly involving either Daleks or giant insects, although thankfully not both at the same time. But my parents, no doubt having watched me watching the Good Doctor fighting the good fight against all manner of hideous menaces, including a man turning into an insect and another who was half Dalek, I was convinced Davros lived in our kitchen for at least half an hour after each instalment of Genesis of the Daleks had ended, had a fairly liberal attitude to the rest of my televisual education. And thus it was that on certain nights of the week, bedtime was postponed until an hour, or maybe two, later than normal, in order to allow me a little extra TV treat. Oftentimes, this would comprise whatever latest comedy act had found its way into my father's affections, Monty Python, Spike Milligan and Dave Allen being the 1970s equivalent of what we'd later consider alternative comedy, I suppose. There's nothing new in the world, they say, and comedy has always been the foremost avenue for subversive think dissemination. But occasionally, I'd be indulged in something rather more substantial. Or at least, something with rather longer episodes. Like Survivors. My mother was responsible for Survivors. I'd like to say she'd started watching out of curiosity, but the fact is we were a BBC family, occasionally straying as far as BBC Two, but rarely in the direction of the other channel, so it's unlikely she would have missed it. She did, however, soon find herself immersed in the affairs of Greg and, particularly, Jenny, and so Survivors quickly became something that wasn't just on, but that was appointment to view. So each week, we made an appointment to view it. Survivors taught me about rabies, for one thing. Or at least, that's how I remembered it. There was a scene in Series 3 where the main characters have to take a diversion on foot through a stream in order to avoid some slavering angry dogs. Actually, I remember slavering angry dogs being the threat throughout most of Survivors, but it turns out that I was remembering things wrong, and that slavering angry dogs were never featured. Cuddly dogs, that couldn't be enticed by the production team into impersonating slavering angry dogs, did turn up once a year though, and the scene I remembered was probably the last time it happened. They weren't rabid either. I remembered that wrong too. I did, however, grow up with an irrational fear of any and all wild animals, and other people's pets, just in case they'd come over on the ferry from France without being checked for rabies first. At around the time the third series of Survivors had bid the real world farewell, just as it was getting its fictional world back on its feet, must have been when I really started getting into reading. Once I discovered the Target books, coincidentally also with the Planet of the Daleks, although I didn't realise this was the same story as I had remembered seeing at the tender age of 4 and a half until I reached the final chapters, which didn't exactly tally with what I was sure I'd seen anyway. I discovered Day of the Triffids. John Wyndham's book was perfect for someone whose favourite author was, by default, Terence Dicks, as the prose was light and the characters were as white, middle-class and RP as the ones that I was reading about from Doctor Who. I probably didn't realise there was any other kind of person, given that by this time I was enrolled in a primary school in a tiny Devon village with only 8 other people to call classmates, none of whom were anything other than white, middle-class and RP. What the Day of the Triffids did, though, along with the sadly departed but fondly obsessed about survivors, I bought the book and read it annually, along with its sequel, which appeared at much the same time, was invest in me a love of the post-apocalypse genre. Living in a tiny Devon village at a time before a funny look from a teacher meant anything other than that your bottom belch had disrupted the class, I'd spent most of the weekends and all of the school holidays roaming the countryside behind our house. There was nothing I liked better than standing on a hill overlooking the estate we lived on and imagining I was the only person left, mostly because this would have meant my brother wouldn't have been partaking of the chocolate cake we generally had after dinner each night, and that meant there would be twice as much for me. It never occurred to me that my mother might simply have made only half as much of it. There was a mostly wonderful TV adaptation of The Day of the Triffids in 1981, but by this point I was old enough to tell the difference between actors and real people, and although it was far better than the Doctor Who they were foisting upon us at the time, it still didn't quite convey the scale of the post-apocalyptic environment I had in my head. It was more than a quarter of a century before television had both the facility and the wherewithal to do either of these stories justice. I can't begin to relay how exciting it was, even at the age of approaching 40, when I discovered that the BBC were going to remake Survivors. Strange how Survivors came first, with Day of the Triffids following on the next year. You'd think a remake of an old TV programme would be less attractive to the general population than an adaptation of a generation's popular novel. And maybe that they arrived in the order they did is what sunk them. But obviously I wasn't the only one with fond memories of Terry Nation's original. Just the only one who made television only in his head, rather than on an actual television as well. Before they'd even shot a frame of deinterlaced video, I knew exactly what it would look like, and the thing I was most looking forward to was seeing how the gang would come together this time. Spending time with the kind of people I'd actually like to have survived the apocalypse with, ones who made cake but didn't eat it, and watching them find a suitable base for their small-scale farming community, as they attempted to get on with the job of surviving in the aftermath of something wonderful. Something terrible, rather. The remake of Survivors, which appeared 4 years after the American phenomenon Lost, disappeared after its second series. Just before that second series was broadcast, The Day of the Triffids was transmitted as a post-Christmas, pre-New Year treat. They both of them left audiences scratching their heads that something that ought to have been, and previously had been, so involving, could leave them so uninvolved. Maybe it's better to make television only in your head. And maybe it's better if the people who pay for television to be made keep the money away from the ones who've spent too much time making television in their heads before getting to make it on an actual television. Because I swear the remake of Survivors and the new adaptation of The Day of the Triffids would have been better if they'd kept it out of the hands of someone who'd obviously dreamed about it far too much and thought about it far too little. Mind you, none of that stopped me loving every minute of the pair of them, flawed as they are. And that reading came from the volume You and Who Else. Hi, I'm JR, as you will just have heard.
Hi, I'm Rob.
And you're listening to You and Who Talking. And this is the episode that's going out in the week of Christmas. So we've decided to make it a little bit of a Christmas special, sort of.
Absolutely. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Merry Christmas, indeed. Yeah, we thought the way You and Who Talking started was with an episode with me on and then with an episode with you on. So we thought that as it was Christmas, we should maybe both come back and do another essay each.
Yeah, I actually like reading my essays because I always think, I hope people read my essays in the way I picture them in my head or the way I read them in my own head. And if I can actually read them to people, maybe they'll hear it exactly like how I intend it. So I actually quite like it being the control freak I am.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Although the thing about reading the essays is, even though you don't have the person reading it to you when you're reading it off the page, I think you always pretty quickly get into their mind.
Yeah, yeah.
But even so, it's nice to have it read to you. So that was me on Survivors. Well, sort of on the new Survivors, but also on the old Survivors and on the Day of the Triffids.
What made you pick that one, JR?
Well, I've always liked post-apocalypse stuff. And when I was growing up, you had the original TV version of Survivors and the BBC's version of Day of the Triffids, both of which got revived more recently. So both of those revivals, for whatever problems they had, were a little bit special to me for one reason or another because of the memories I had of those series when I was a kid.
Oh, nice. And I guess the same goes for me with what I've picked, Talons of Wang Chiang, which is our next essay. Mm-hmm. That just resonates with me as something I watched as a young kid and I still watch today and still love. And I give some particular reasons why I love it.
Yes. And that, of course, is... as we discussed on the Blue Box podcast the other week, I think there's a case to be made for the Talons of Wang Chiang being sort of the definitive Doctor Who story. In spite of a few things that it does that you don't normally see in Doctor Who, I think you could probably say that about most Doctor Who stories. And I think this one is in some ways definitive, but I shan't go into too many things about that now.
I heard that, but basically you were saying on that podcast, because it's in the past, but they're doing stuff, sci-fi stuff, and there's a bit of everything.
Yeah, a bit of everything in there. And including lots of things that you don't normally get in Doctor Who. But as I say, I think things you don't normally get in Doctor Who is something you expect in Doctor Who. So it kind of ticks all the boxes.
Oh, it certainly does. It's just glorious.
Right. I think you and I should go off and have a glass of something probably fizzy and not very good for us. And let the listeners listen to your essay.
Always. Merry Christmas, JR.
Merry Christmas to you, Rob, and of course, Merry Christmas to all of you at home.
The Curse of Talons. The Talons of Wang Chiang by Rob Irwin, 37, well, at the time, Sydney, Australia. First story, Revenge of the Cybermen. Victorian London. All you have to do is read those two words, or hear them spoken, and I can guarantee it won't be long before most people are thinking of pea soup fogs, Sherlock Holmes, the East End, Jack the Ripper, lonely bobbies wandering through the night, and bodies being pulled out of the River Thames. Funnily enough, all of those things are present, or are at least mentioned, in the Talons of Wang Chiang. So if we can put aside for the moment the sparkling Robert Holmes script and the above-average acting for 1970s Doctor Who in general, I'm of the belief that the story means quite a lot to me, and if countless fan polls are to be believed, quite a few of you reading this essay too, because it hits multiple bullseyes on all the tropes the audience is looking for in a Victorian London-based story. And yet it goes much further than that. When I find myself working on story ideas for non-Doctor Who novels that I never have time to write, I often have to stop myself from setting at least half of them in Victorian London. Why? I think there's something a little intoxicating about all those tropes I mentioned, and if you're a Doctor Who fan, throw in the Talons of Wang Chiang on top of that, and voila, you have a creepy, cold, gritty, yet strangely colourful kind of setting for crime fiction or an adventure story in general. Who wouldn't want their characters walking down those streets if you had half a chance for them to be your backdrop? Indeed, the more I've thought about it while preparing this essay, the more I've come to the conclusion that the talents of Wang Chiang has been massively influential on the way I think about the era in general. When I try and visualize, for example, how a police station or mortuary from the era might look, I end up visualizing scenes from this story. When I try and conjure up a music hall impresario of the era, who else but Henry Gordon Jago appears in my head? Ditto for a man of science from the era, if not Holmes, then Lightfoot it is. I'm going to call it The Curse of Talons, a story that hits its mark so well it's almost impossible not to invoke it when you're thinking, reading, or writing about the era in general. And that's some achievement. Thankfully, I know I'm not the only one afflicted by the curse. I mentioned the combination of Robert Holmes' script and some above-average acting a moment ago, and I think they play a massive role in why this story is such a winner. This isn't one of those stories where you have to play the role of a fan apologist with remarks to your pals like, "What I think the writer was trying to do was," or, "This is actually a great story, and if you read the Target novel, you can see the real storyline and forget all about the acting." Because both the script and the acting are spot on too. It's no accident that this story falls in a season that also includes The Deadly Assassin, The Robots of Death, and others of that ilk. This was a golden age, not just for Tom Baker in the lead role, but the series in general. Besides, who can forget lines like, "Never trust a man with dirty fingernails," or one of my favourites delivered by the Doctor to Leela with a warm smile, "If you're very good, I'll buy you an orange." Yes, this is a solid gold example of Doctor Who writing that is light-hearted and fun to watch without ever being over the top or slapstick. Robert Holmes truly was a master wordsmith. Hammering home that this is not only a good but incredibly influential story for many Doctor Who fans besides myself, is a quote I found from Russell T. Davis regarding The Talons of Wang Chiang. He says, "Watch episode 1. It's the best dialogue ever written. It's up there with Dennis Potter by a man called Robert Holmes. When the history of television drama comes to be written, Robert Holmes won't be remembered at all because he only wrote genre stuff, and that, I reckon, is a real tragedy." When I look back on this era of Doctor Who in general, I'm struck by how many stories I genuinely like without the need for rose-tinted glasses, and The Talons of Wang Chiang in particular is not only very likeable, but also plays a key role in cementing the way in which I think most of us view the mid-Tom Baker era. It's well written, it's well acted, the sets are great, and the music is entirely appropriate to the action. This is a classic for the ages. And that comes from You and Who, Contact Has Been Made, Volume 1.
And this is JR back again.
And Rob.
And
it's me.
And now that you've listened to it all, and before you go to bed and wait to see what Santa's going to bring you, you could be a little bit of a Santa Claus for us.
Yes.
This is the challenge we're laying down. We are, after next week's episode, going to be taking a little bit of a break with You and Who Talking, but we will be back a little bit later on in the year. It won't be too long, hopefully. But we, of course, are always on the lookout for new essays. So if you've written for any of the You and Who books, or even if you haven't and you've liked what you've been listening to for the past few months, write something, turn your recording device on, whatever it is, even if it's a mobile phone, we don't mind. We can mess about with the files and make them sound a little bit nicer. Record us something and either get in touch with Rob or myself and send us your recording and be on a future episode of You and Who Talking.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of our best examples haven't actually been essays from the books. People have just sat down and thought, okay, so that's what they do in the books. I'll just write one here, you know, just on spec and send it in. And that's what they've done. And it's wonderful.
Yeah. So we would absolutely love to have a whole load more of those so that we can keep You and Who Talking going for as long as possible.
Absolutely. Merry Christmas again, JR.
And a Merry Christmas to you too. You've been listening to You and Who Talking, presented by Rob Irwin with J.R. Southall. The You and Who books, from which all royalties are paid to charity, are available in print and for Kindle from watchingbooks.weebly.com.